was more like early Jamestown, a group of unattached men with relatively little in common. In the beginning, their energies were directed toward building a fort. But once that was completed, they were unprepared to face the rigors of a hard New England winter. As in Jamestown, a state of almost unaccountable languor quickly descended on the inhabitants. Suffering from a deadly combination of malnutrition and despair, the colonists appeared powerless to adapt to the demands of the New World. It was quite possible, the Pilgrims insisted, for Weston's men to survive. Even without corn and migratory birds, there were still shellfish, including oysters, which were not available at Plymouth, along the water's edge at Wissagusset. There were also groundnuts, fleshy potato-like tubers that grew in clusters beneath the ground. Rather than give up, they must strive to feed themselves. But to seek food required them to leave the safety of their fortress. And unlike Plymouth, where the closest Indian village was 15 miles away, Wissagusset was set right beside a Massachusetts settlement. Not only was the threat of attack greater, but there was also an even more powerful form of temptation. The Indians possessed stores of corn that they were saving for the spring. Why spend the day rooting for clams in the cold mud when there was so much corn for the taking? In February, John Sanders, the settlement's leader, wrote to Governor Bradford asking if it was right to steal a few hogsheads of corn, especially if they promised to reimburse the Indians once they'd grown their own corn in the summer. This was, of course, almost exactly what the Pilgrims had done 2 years before. But Bradford urged them to leave the corn alone, for it might so exasperate the Indians that all of us might smart for it. In desperation, Sanders sailed to the east in hopes of securing some provisions from a fishing outpost on the island of Monhegan. He left his plantation in a state of misery and disorder. One morning they found a man dead in the tidal flats, waist deep in muck and apparently too feeble to extract himself. As the sufferings of Weston's men increased, the Indians, who were already resentful of the English interlopers, began to harass them unmercifully. They scoffed at their weakness and even snatched from their hands what few clams and groundnuts they had been able to gather. Some of the English resorted to trading their clothes for food until they were reduced to naked, trembling skeletons of wretchedness. Others contracted themselves out as servants to the Indians. One man, according to Winslow, willingly became an Indian. About this time, Miles Standish traveled to Manomet, just 15 miles to the south of Plymouth, to pick up some of the corn Bradford had secured during his trading voyage with Squanto. Standish was being entertained by Sachem Canicum when two Massachusetts Indians arrived with word from Sachem Obtachius at Wissagusset. One of the Indians was a warrior of immense pride named Wituamat, who bragged of having once killed several French sailors. Wituamat possessed an ornately carved knife that he had taken from one of his victims. Soon after his arrival, he presented the knife to Canicum and began a long speech in an audacious manner. Without the assistance of an interpreter, Standish was not sure what Wituamat was saying, but he did know that once the Indian had completed his speech, he, not Standish, became Canicum's favored guest, and Wituamat's entertainment much exceeded the captain's. Standish was not the sort to overlook a social slight. Where Bradford was willing to give even a potential traitor the benefit of the doubt, Standish was quick to take offense. He objected vehemently to his treatment by Canicum and chastised the two Massachusetts Indians for their refusal to pay him the proper respect. In an attempt to pacify the captain, Canicum insisted that Standish invite his three English compatriots, who were then loading the shallop with corn, to join them beside the fire. But Standish would have none of it. He stormed out of the wigwam and resolved to spend the night with his men at the temporary rendezvous they had built beside the shallop. Standish's indignant furor appears to have blinded him to the fact that something of far more consequence than a social rebuff had occurred at Manomet. Only in hindsight did Standish see the interchange between Wituamat and Canicum as the first indication that the Indians in the region were conspiring against them. For as it turned out, he and Witiamat were destined to meet again. While Standish was at Manomet, word reached Plymouth that Massasoit was gravely ill. Bradford decided he must send an emissary not only to attend to Massasoit, but to make contact with the crew of a Dutch vessel that had reportedly been driven ashore almost to the door of the Sachem's wigwam. Since Winslow had already visited Massasoit and could speak Dutch, he was chosen for the expedition to Pokanoket. Winslow was accompanied by Habermack and John Hampden, a gentleman from London who was wintering with the pilgrims, and about midway in their 40-mile journey, they received word from some Indians that Massasoit was dead. "This news struck us blank," Winslow wrote. The Indians also said that the Dutch had succeeded in refloating their vessel and had already left Pokanoket. Habermack was the most profoundly affected by the unsubstantiated news of the Sachem's passing, and he insisted that they return immediately to Plymouth. But Winslow was not so sure. If Massasoit was dead, then Corbettant, who lived just to the east of Pokanoket, would in all likelihood succeed him, even though he was, in Winslow's words, a most hollow-hearted friend toward us. It might be in their best interests to stop at Corbettant's village and pay their respects. Given that less than a year ago, both Winslow and Habermack had been part of an expedition sent to kill Corbettant, who had reportedly murdered Squanto, it was an extremely hazardous proposition. But after some reflection, all of them thought it worth the risk. As they made their way to Corbettant's village, Habermack could not contain his sorrow over the loss of Massasoit. "My loving Sachem, my loving Sachem," he cried. "Many have I known, but never any like thee." He said that with Massasoit's death, he feared Plymouth had not a faithful friend left among the Indians. He then proceeded to deliver a eulogy that still stands as a remarkably timeless description of an ideal leader. "He was no liar. He was not bloody and cruel. In anger and passion he was soon reclaimed. Easy to be reconciled toward such as had offended him, he ruled by reason in such measure as he would not scorn the advice of mean men. And he governed his men better with few strokes than others did with many, truly loving where he loved." Corbettant, they soon discovered, was not at home. He was still at Pokanoket, his wife said. She wasn't sure whether or not Massasoit was still alive. Winslow hired a runner to go to Pokanoket to get the latest news. Just a half hour before sunset, the messenger returned with word that the Sachem was not yet dead, though there was no hope we should find him living. Winslow resolved to set out immediately for Pokanoket. It was still dark when they arrived at Massasoit's village. His wigwam was so jammed with people that they had difficulty making their way to the Sachem's side. Several powwows hovered over him, making such a hellish noise as it distempered us that were well, Winslow wrote. Massasoit's arms, legs, and thighs were being worked over by half a dozen women who chafed his skin to keep heat in him. During a lull, Winslow requested that Massasoit be informed that his friends, the English, were come to see him. The Sachem was unable to see, but he could still hear. He weakly asked which one of the English was present. The Indians said Winslow's name as Winsnow, and Massasoit responded, "Keen Winsnow," or "Are you Winslow?" The pilgrim answered, "Ahi," or "Yes." Massasoit's response, "Mata nin wan kanet namen Winsnow," or "Oh, Winslow, I shall never see thee again." Winslow explained that Governor Bradford had wished he could be there, but pressing business had required him to remain at Plymouth. In his stead, he had come with some medicines and foods, most likely to do the Sachem good in this, his extremity. Massasoit had eaten nothing in a very long time, and Winslow attempted to feed him some fruit preserves administered on the tip of a knife. Once the sweetened fruit had dissolved in Massasoit's mouth, he swallowed, for the first time in 2 days. Winslow began to examine the interior of the Sachem's mouth. It was exceedingly furred, and his tongue was so swollen that it was little wonder he had been unable to eat anything. After scraping the corruption from his mouth and tongue, Winslow fed him more of the preserves. Massasoit may have been suffering from typhus, probably brought to the village by the recently departed Dutch traders. Spread by infected lice, typhus was known as pestilential fever in the 17th century and was most common in winter and spring. Typhus thrived in the crowded, unsanitary conditions typical of an Indian or, for that matter, English village of the time, and there were also several other Pokanokets suffering from the disease. According to a modern description of typhus, symptoms include fever and chills, vomiting, constipation or diarrhea, muscle ache and delirium or stupor. The tongue is first coated with a white fur, which then turns brown. The body develops small red eruptions, which may bleed. In severe cases, the mortality rate can reach 70%. Within a half hour of receiving his first taste of Winslow's fruit preserves, Massasoit had improved to the extent that his sight had begun to return. Winslow had brought several bottles of medicines, but they had broken along the way. He asked Massasoit if he could send a messenger to get some more from the surgeon back in Plymouth, as well as a couple of chickens, so that he might cook up a broth. This was readily agreed to, and by 2 a.m., a runner was on his way with a letter from Winslow. The next day, Massasoit was well enough to ask Winslow to shoot a duck and make an English pottage similar to what he had sampled at Plymouth. Fearing that his stomach was not yet ready for meat, Winslow insisted that he first try a more easily digested pottage of greens and herbs. Neither Winslow nor John Hamden had any experience in making such a concoction, however, and after much hunting about, they were able to find only a few strawberry leaves and a sassafras root. They boiled the two together, and after straining the results through Winslow's handkerchief and combining it with some roasted corn, they fed the mixture to Massasoit. He drank at least a pint of the broth and soon had his first bowel movement in 5 days. Before fading off to sleep, the sachem asked Winslow to wash out the mouths of all the others who were sick in the village, saying they were good folk. Reluctantly, the pilgrim envoy went about the work of scraping the mouths of all who desired it, a duty he admitted to finding much offensive to me, not being accustomed with such poisonous savors. This was a form of diplomacy that went far beyond the usual exchange of pleasantries and gifts. That afternoon, Winslow shot a duck and prepared to feed Massasoit the promised pottage. By this time, the sachem had improved remarkably. "Never did I see a man so low recover in that measure in so short a time," Winslow wrote. The duck's meat was quite fatty, and Winslow said it was important to skim the grease from the top of the broth, but Massasoit was now ravenous and insisted on making a gross meal of it, gobbling down the duck, fat and all. An hour later, he was vomiting so violently that he began to bleed from the nose. For the next 4 hours, the blood poured from his nose, and Winslow began to fear that this might be the end. But eventually the bleeding stopped, and the sachem slept for close to 8 hours. When he awoke, he was feeling so much better that he asked that the two chickens, which had just arrived from Plymouth, be kept as breeding stock, rather than cooked for his benefit. All the while, Indians from as many as 100 miles away continued to arrive at Pokanoket. Before Winslow's appearance, many of those in attendance had commented on the absence of the English and suggested that they cared little about Massasoit's welfare. With this remarkable recovery, everything had changed. "Now I see the English are my friends and love me," Massasoit announced to the assembled multitude. "And whilst I live, I will never forget this kindness they have showed me." Before their departure, Massasoit took Habermas aside and had some words with the trusted Panisse. Not until the following day, after they had spent the night with Corpetent, who now declared himself to be one of the pilgrim's staunchest allies, did Habermas reveal the subject of his conversation with Massasoit. Plymouth, the sachem claimed, was in great danger. Pushed to the limit of their endurance by Weston's men at Wessagusset, the Massachusetts had decided they must wipe out the settlement. But to attack Wessagusset would surely incite the wrath of the pilgrims, who would feel compelled to revenge the deaths of their countrymen. The only solution, the Massachusetts had determined, was to launch raids on both English settlements. But the Massachusetts had just 40 warriors. If they were to attack Wessagusset and Plymouth simultaneously, they needed help. Massasoit claimed that they had succeeded in gaining the support of half a dozen villages on Cape Cod, as well as the Indians at Menomet and Martha's Vineyard. An assault was imminent, Massasoit insisted, and the only option the Pilgrims had was to kill the men of Massachusetts, who were the authors of this intended mischief. If the Pilgrims waited until after the Indians had attacked Wessagusset, it would be too late. By then, the region-wide native force would have been assembled, and the multitude of adversaries would overwhelm them. They must act without delay to take away the principals, and then the plot would cease. It was terrifying to learn that they were, in Winslow's words, at the pit's brim, and yet feared nor knew not that we were in danger. They must return to Plymouth as soon as possible and inform Governor Bradford. After more than 2 years of threatened violence, it now appeared that the Pilgrims might have no choice but to go to war. As Winslow, Habermock, and John Hampden were hurrying back to Plymouth, Phineas Pratt, a 30-year-old joiner who had become, by default, one of the leaders of the sorry settlement of Wessagusset, was beginning to think it was time to escape this hellhole and find his way to Plymouth. Their sufferings had become unendurable. They had nothing to eat, and the Indians were becoming increasingly belligerent. The warriors, led by a Pinnice named Pecksuot, gathered outside the wall of the Wessagusset fort. "Machit Pesconk," they shouted, which Pratt translated as "naughty guns." An attack seemed at hand, so the English increased the number of men on watch. But without food, the guards began to die at their posts. One bitterly cold night, Pratt reported for guard duty. "I saw one man dead before me," he remembered, "and another man dead at my right hand and another at my left for want of food." Word reached the settlement from an Englishman living with the Indians that the Massachusetts planned to attack both Wessagusset and Plymouth. Sachem Abtakiast was waiting for the snow to melt so that his warriors' footprints could not be tracked when they left for the other settlement. "Their plot was to kill all the English people in one day," Pratt wrote. He decided he must leave as soon as possible for Plymouth. "If the Plymouth men know not of this treacherous plot," he told his compatriots, "they and we are all dead men." With a small pack draped across his back, he walked out of the settlement as casually as he could manage with a hoe in his hand. He began to dig at the edge of a large swamp, pretending to search for groundnuts. He looked to his right and to his left and, seeing no Indians, disappeared into the swamp. He ran till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There were patches of snow everywhere, and he feared the Indians had followed his footprints and would soon be upon him. Clouds moved in, making it difficult to determine the position of the sun and the direction in which he was traveling. "I wandered," he wrote, "not knowing my way." But at sunset, the western sky became tinged with red, providing him with the orientation he needed. As darkness overtook him, he heard a great howling of wolves. He came to a river and, skittering over the rocks, drenched himself in the chilly water. He was tired, hungry, and cold, but he feared to light a fire since it might be seen by the Indians. He came to a deep gorge into which several trees had fallen. "Then I said in my thoughts," he wrote, "this is God's providence that here I may make a fire." As he attempted to warm himself beside the feeble blaze, the sky above miraculously cleared, and he stared up at the stars. Recognizing Ursa Major, he was able to determine the direction he should go the next morning. By 3 in the afternoon, he had reached the site of what would become the village of Duxbury, just to the north of Plymouth. As he ran across the shallows of the Jones River, haunted by the fear that the Indians were about to catch up to him, he said to himself, "Now am I a deer chased by wolves." He found a well-worn path. He was bounding down a hill when up ahead he saw an Englishman walking toward him. It was John Hampden, the gentleman from London who had recently